Hey, and welcome to another episode of Highbrow Lowbrow. Today is October 26th, and this is our 86th episode. Jesse, what is Highbrow Lowbrow all about?
Highbrow Lowbrow, a film survey wherein Sean and I view two movies from a particular year. The Highbrow Choice is the Best Picture Academy Award winner. The Lowbrow Choice is the top box office movie from that same year. We compare and contrast and try to have a lively discussion.
Excellent. As always, we always have a lively discussion. You can check us out on the web at hlpod.blogspot.com. And you can also find us on Facebook at highbrow exclamation point lowbrow question mark. Be sure to subscribe to our feed on iTunes or any podcast URL feeds by looking for a highbrow exclamation point lowbrow question mark. Although that's not really too relevant because we are coming to an end where our podcast is, this is our second to last episode. We are going to have one more additional podcast that'll happen after this one. But after this episode, this is the last Oscar, Best Picture Oscar Academy Award winner and top box office earner. We've watched everything from 86 years of the Oscars and top box office earners. So
86 years of pomp and circumstance, man.
Yeah.
86 years of many unworthy winners.
Yeah. I mean, we've been through some clunkers, but we've made some awesome discoveries,
sure.
I feel.
Yeah, sure.
I guess there's no comments to be made, which I guess, you know, I wasn't expecting a comment, but yeah, I mean, we're just coming to the end. We have some plans for the final episode, but yes, this is our last episode where we'll be talking about Oscar winners and top box office winners or ones that we haven't seen yet, because now we've seen them all.
For real, man.
Yeah. So, Jesse, what else have you watched besides our two picks from this week?
Yeah, well, I'll dive in. Documentary first. I knew it was you, rediscovering John Cazale, or okay. Cazale. Best known as Fredo from the Godfather series.
Ah, yeah.
That's the guy. You know, a bit of trivia about this actor. All five movies that he starred in his lifetime were nominated for Best Picture Academy Awards. So it ties in a little bit with our show here in terms of that recognition. Let's see if I can name them. Godfather 1, Godfather 2, The Conversation, also a Francis Ford Coppola movie.
Oh, yeah.
The Deer Hunter and Dog Day Afternoon. So there you go.
Wow.
And I guess Godfather 3 has some archival footage of John Cazale as well. And that was nominated for Best Picture, I believe, as well. So technically 6, but yeah, I don't know. That said, I knew it was you rediscovering John Cazale. It's only about an hour long, and it's not a great documentary, might venture to say. I mean, there's some good talking heads. You know, lady love in his lifetime, at the end of his life at least, was Meryl Streep. Sure, she's there. Robert De Niro is there. Of course, he's got some things to say from The Deer Hunter. I think The Deer Hunter was his last role. He died of cancer. He was a really heavy smoker.
Yeah.
I think that's what took its toll. So not an amazing movie. I mean, but he is seriously revered. Contemporary actor Sam Rockwell is just singing his praises.
And oh, really?
Oh, he loves him so much. I can't say that I'm as big a fan of Cazale because he just makes me so sad when I watch him. Like,
yeah,
if you think of every single one of those characters, maybe with the exception of The Conversation, which is a bit more comedic, that part. But I don't think you've seen that movie yet, The Conversation.
Was it?
Gene Hackman is the lead. It's an incredible movie, man. I think you would love it.
What is it about again?
Okay.
Just give me like
it's about a conversation. Gene Hackman is it's kind of a technical thing to try to describe, but
audio.
He's a master in his field as an audio technician.
Yeah, I've seen it,
and you have seen it. Okay.
Yeah, I have seen it.
I mean, did it strike you as much as it did me? Because
oh yeah, it was amazing.
Blew me away.
It was amazing.
Yeah,
I mean
yeah.
The ending, you know, piece of it was fantastic.
Oh yeah, not only that though, it was great throughout. But
it was, but yeah, I love the conversation.
Yeah, Cazale, he makes me very sad. So. Mm-hmm. I don't love him as much, and I don't find as much variety from role to role, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
He just,
I don't know. I mean, you know, that sort of, I think, rings true, though, is that, you know, actors don't necessarily have to bring variety. They just have to bring truth to a role.
Yeah, so it could have been that he's just getting similar kind of put-upon characters.
Yeah,
I mean,
but then, yeah. I don't know, if he sells it well, he sells it well.
Yeah, I'm not going to begrudge him that. So anyway, if there are any super fans of any of those movies, then, you know, it probably would be fun for you to check out this documentary. Yeah.
But I mean, I do think though that Cazale hasn't really like stood out to me. I mean, he's like, he's good, you know, he's entertaining, but
right.
I mean, like, I wouldn't like jump and
apparently him. He was even better on the stage. That's what it's funny because this movie is produced by the Beastie Boys film imprint, or maybe it's Adam Yauch's, and Adam Horowitz, aka Ad Rock, his dad is a playwright, and he had a really close relationship with John Cazale. So John Cazale was in a bunch of his plays. He's one of the talking heads, and it's all about reverence, you know? That's what that one's all about.
No doubt.
Moving on. I think it's an Iranian director. It's a French language movie, I believe, called The Past. The reason I got onto this one is because there was a movie I watched last year, I think, or earlier this year, called A Separation, which I recommended highly to you. I think it actually won the Best Academy Award for Movies from the year 2013, perhaps. I might be wrong about that. But anyway, The Past is great sort of domestic drama. I'll give you a short synopsis. This guy goes back home to finalize his divorce from his ex-wife, and he gets embroiled in all this familial drama that his ex-wife is dealing with. And he thinks he's extricated himself from it, but he keeps getting drawn in, and he tries to help his stepdaughters, you know, who he had previously been a parent to. And then his ex-lady friend has a new love, and there's a lot of anyway. Huh. That's not a great setup, maybe, but excellent acting, great story twists. I was actually blown away by it. I thought it was a great movie. Yeah. The Past. If you can't deal with subtitles, then you won't like it.
Okay.
Another documentary, Anita Hill. Anita, speaking truth to power.
Okay.
Your thoughts on Anita Hill. Do you feel that she was being truthful against Clarence Thomas in the early 90s? Do you have any knowledge of this case, this groundbreaking case?
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking
about?
No,
I know what you're talking about. Clarence Thomas, he was a Supreme Court.
He was a nominee at the time.
Nominee. Yeah. And then Anita Thomas.
Anita Hill.
Yeah, or Anita Hill, I'm sorry. Did she sink him? She didn't sink him, right?
No, she didn't. But, well, yeah, so she didn't. I mean, she tarnished his reputation to a certain extent. So she decided to testify against, or just bring evidence against him, which is that he sexually harassed her pretty severely. Yeah. In the early 80s, and he's nominated to be a Supreme Court judge, which is a pretty big deal, of course, in the United States. You know, this movie's fine. It's just, I didn't find her very compelling, or the way the filmmakers portrayed her, it just did not keep my attention. This movie is only an hour and 20 minutes long, and I was just sitting there thinking, like, 20 minutes could have been chopped, you know? Granted, I'm a man, so I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it more... I respect her heroism and her coming forward and speaking truth to power. I mean, it is pretty striking to see her so composed, facing up against a huge table of senators, many of whom are legendary figures. I mean, one of whom was Joe Biden, the current vice president. Just asking her all these ridiculous questions as though she's the one that's on trial. But all she was doing is try to bring evidence and say, hey, consider this. This is the guy you're nominating here.
Yeah, yeah.
But they started, and she's a law professor, kind of unimpeachable, you know, college law professor.
Yeah.
So if anything, she might have been the one who would possibly in the future have been nominated to be a Supreme Court justice because of her great untarnished record, let's say, and her pedigree. So she risked a lot and she lost a lot by coming forward to, you know, just call out Clarence Thomas for past misbehavior. So, but I just didn't think it was a great movie. I don't know. Maybe there's another good movie to be made there. It's an HBO documentary, you know, it's got some serious clout behind it.
I mean, it might not be the story, it might just be the storytellers.
That's true. Yeah, they just didn't make her seem that interesting, I'll be honest with you. I've got a couple more. I decided to watch Roman Holiday, classic Hollywood, although I say that it's filmed exclusively in Rome, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you see there in the production, it's actually quite lavish with the sights of Italy. And of course, our...
Cary Grant?
No, Gregory Peck
and
Audrey Hepburn.
Right.
It's pretty much all about those two, although Gregory Peck has a photographer pal in it. Reason I watched this, William Wyler, our new favorite director based on the highbrow, lowbrow list. We just watched Mrs. Miniver very recently. So another entry in his canon, Roman Holiday. I mean, this guy really has quite a varied filmography because this one is nearly an out-and-out comedy. I mean, romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, Audrey Hepburn is so skinny. It's crazy, man. She's so slender. She's very, very lovely, very attractive. And Gregory Peck is just, you know, the man.
Yeah.
The American pity, man.
Epitome of manliness.
That's right, you know, sure.
Do-rightness. Yeah.
I thought this was a great movie. Roman Holiday, man. I loved it.
Yeah,
it's
on Instant Queue, isn't it?
I believe it is on Netflix. Yeah, if you want to go there, please do.
We'll try to check it out eventually.
I'm nearly done, and you can chime in on this one, I hope.
Yeah.
You kind of begged me, not begged me, but you said we should watch this one. So I did my part, man. You know what you're talking about? What we're talking about? The Most Dangerous Game.
The Most Dangerous Game.
From 1932. Yeah, Did you actually indulge?
Yeah, I watched it.
Man, it wasn't that good. Come on.
I thought it had a cool premise, though.
It was a good premise. It's true. Tell the premise.
So the premise is that this sort of Dudley Do-Right hunter character, this great hunter, finds himself shipwrecked on this island, and he finds himself pitted against this other sort of admirer slash fellow hunter who wants to hunt the deadliest game or the most dangerous game.
Right.
And we find out that what he considers the most dangerous game is to be man, and they go on.
Yeah.
And so he goes on a manhunt. Right. For the main character, and you know, chases him around the island trying to, you know.
It's a good premise.
Yeah,
it's a good premise. What do you think of the execution then? I mean,
I don't know. Yeah. You know, the hero was mainly just, you know, your sort of stock hero. I didn't really get the sense.
I didn't think that actor was very good at all.
Yeah, he wasn't that strong. I did like the villain. He was sort of like, you know, really campy fun.
Oh yeah, man! It's B movie.
Yeah.
Before we knew what a B movie was, maybe.
Yeah. So that was pretty
fun.
Yeah,
his eyes are always bulging out, and he's got like a big scar on the side of his head that he continually fingers whenever he's troubled by something.
Oh, I remember. I love that. The scar touching.
That's right. That it's a awesome. Funny device. You know what's interesting about a couple of details that I picked up on? Well, of course, it stars Faye Ray, who I think the next year is starring King Kong.
Yeah.
And it's paired with the same director. So this is like a prelude to their great success.
Yeah.
And I swear I had like, you know, flashbacks to listening to her screams in King Kong because her screams are in full effect. Well, not quite as full effect, but a lot of screams in The Most Dangerous Game. And then this is pretty random, but there's a Bay Area connection here. The Zodiac Killer, who, of course, David Fincher made the movie Zodiac. It's even a little bit of that movie that in some of the Zodiac letters, he actually quoted lines of dialogue from The Most Dangerous Game as, you know, along the lines of, hey, I'm hunting people, I'm killing people. This is, you know, he had that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, he had that connection with that movie. Who knows if that's something that killer saw when he was a kid and he connected with, or he saw it on late night TV on a rerun or something. So that's an odd one.
I mean, you know, when the movie first starts out, it's sort of cool because it has like this big lion knocker thing on a door, and he knocks the door, and then it sort of like does like this fade open the door into the title credits. When it started, I thought it had a really sort of cool initial.
Some of those scenes, those dialogue scenes, just dragged on and on. There was so much exposition, and it was just unnecessary, I felt.
And then also, I think the brother of Faye Ray. He sort of had a pretty comical performance. I forget if I liked it or not, though. I watched it a while ago.
The whole reason you asked me to watch that movie is because it is also from 1932.
Yeah.
This is our episode is focused on that year.
Yeah.
Was that even at the top of the box office list?
Is it was
that
how you
found it? It was somewhere up there.
Yeah, it was. The deal is that when we went to look for the top box office earner of 1932, we came across several selections. We got The Kid from Spain. We got Shanghai Express, the movie that we did end up choosing.
Right.
The Most Dangerous Game. And then also, I think, one other one.
Right. I don't remember. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And so we had a much...
had to make a decision based on availability, largely. I mean, if you read the plot summary for The Kid from Spain, that one's the most compelling to me, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I'll have some things to say about Shanghai Express, of course. But
yeah.
You can share the most about The Kid from Spain. I only came across one clip, which is
what a perfect combination.
There you go. Eddie Cantor and his best Al Jolson impression.
Yeah, in straight up blackface with the
tough, man. It's tough.
And then, you know, doing that whole like big eyed, you know,
what I was going to speculate actually when we spoke about this a little bit earlier is, you know, you know that the studios would give training to actors and actresses, and you start to wonder like if they have like a blackface unit, you know, where it's like, we need to help you know how much the whites of your eyes can translate when in blackface, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Al Jolson is giving a special lesson on the Friday afternoon.
I don't know. I bet blackface was like a lot more prevalent in the TV.
No doubt.
So it probably was just like a part of the culture. It's like,
I've read a little bit about it, that it was supposed to be some great show of respect, like, which is hard to square with how we see it now. It just looks horrible now. But a show of respect, like, oh, we love the black entertainers so much, we want to kind of express ourselves in that way and put on the, you know.
But I mean, I don't know. Makeup. If you watch the clip on YouTube or I don't know whatever other formats you can find it from The Kid from Spain, the song's called "What a Perfect Combination." It still has like a lot of talent and a lot of, you know, singing, you know, strength and all that good stuff that comes from
incredible choreography. Yeah. I mean, the very well acclaimed name that kind of lives in choreography history, Busby Berkeley, directed that sequence and choreographed it. And just the way the female chorus enters is stunning.
I mean,
so it made me want to see more, but you watched a few more clips. I mean, what
speaking of the female chorus is actually another sequence that actually is somewhat titillating. It has like various girls of the female chorus. I don't know why they're sort of gathered together, but they're, I guess they're all like some big sort of group that hangs out like at a school or something.
Okay.
And they're all in their 90s in their beds, and they're all like sort of you know, extolling their virtues as like, you know, lovely ladies and like and wanting boys and stuff, and so they sort of sing, have this like song they sing, and they're like, oh, I'm so shy, you know, that sort of thing. And they take a bath together in like some giant pool where they do like some dance swim choreography.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, but yeah, so I don't know, you get all these like sort of cute shots of all these like attractive 20s girl or 30s girls.
Yeah, I mean, we've got our audience of salivating men is rushing to their Google.
So that was pretty entertaining.
Okay, it's worth mentioning that these early 30s movies are I don't have enough understanding of it, but they're pre-Hollywood code.
Yeah.
When is that 34 that was instituted? I think so, yeah. I believe some kind of a vulgarity, anti-vulgarity clause that came in. And so yeah, of course we can always go back to when we saw Wings. Mm-hmm. There's the woman character who's literally topless. I mean, from the back, but that was the first Academy Award Best Picture, and so it's weird to see that in a late 20s movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, what are we to believe that, you know, that people weren't pretty randy back then as well? Certainly not, but the expression and entertainment was much more stifled, particularly from, I think it was 1934 onward with that Hollywood code being instituted.
Yeah. And then, so that, yeah, that was an unexpected bit of, you know, I don't know, voyeurism or just like, extra skin, I guess.
Yeah.
From a 1930s film. There was one other clip that I'd like to talk about. There was like an intro clip that's not of any note.
We're still talking about the kid from Spain.
Yeah, here. The kid from Spain. There's one more clip. This clip features Eddie Cantor doing bullfighting, and I think that's the main feature of the film, or that's what, you know, he thought would sell the audiences is the bullfighting, and bullfighting can have some comical, you know, back and forth.
Sure. Well, I think the idea is his character is in disguise as a famous bullfighter.
Yeah.
And of course, that character
and
is
in peril. And he just sort of flips around and tries to, like, you know, zany his way out of it, you know?
Right.
And it was pretty, you know, that part was pretty entertaining. I mean, it, you know, typical sort of pratfall-y type of stuff.
Sure.
But it was sort of his inspiration for doing the movie because he was inspired by a friend who went to Spain to learn to be a writer, I think, but then ended up being a bullfighter, and it's what inspired Eddie Cantor to make this movie.
Okay. Sean went cross country to try to find a copy of this movie. We spoke about it in our last episode, but I mean, you can't get a DVD of The Kid from Spain. I don't know why that is. Or we could buy like a second generation VHS copy for $40 off eBay. I'm kind of not into that.
Yeah.
So that's why we switched up our plan for this episode. Anyway, we gave you a little taste of The Kid from Spain. Delving into Sean's picks now. Go ahead.
All right. So now we're transitioning from that. Speaking of movies that have racially charged themes.
Please.
We have Dear White People. This is a recently released film about a group of students
college students
in this university, Winchester University, and the black students are sort of fighting this recently passed amendment that allows for, I don't know, a way to organize living arrangements that I guess are racially charged or something. So they start rallying against that and you know, bringing up the virtues of black power while talking all about the hypocrisy of, you know, white people adopting black culture. This movie was, you know, pretty entertaining. It goes to some familiar places, like some of the familiar arguments. I mean, but then it's illustrated sort of youthfully and fun. So it's relatively pretty fun and entertaining. And then there's a couple of pretty cool characters. The main character, Sam White, I don't know the actress's name, but the main character, Sam White, he's very interesting and you know, exciting and snarky, but provides a good backdrop as the main voice. And then we also have, I don't know what the fellow's name is, but he was from Everybody Hates Chris, the Chris Rock show.
Sure.
He played a really good role as Lionel Higgins, this black homosexual kid that sort of finds himself outcasted from the black community and from the gay community. He's not really sure where he lies. So most of the time he's trying to like meekly wander his way through this sea of culture, and he's just finding it difficult to like find a side to be on. And I think that's a lot of what the movie's about, is people trying to find
identity,
right? Identity mm-hmm. in college and how it reflects.
Sorry to interrupt. I just read an interview with the director actually, and I think it somewhat parallels his experience. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that he went to a mostly white college, and I think he's mixed race as well. He's biracial.
Yeah.
And so there must be a character or two.
Sure.
There's definitely some autobiography here, but he seems like an up and coming talent. He's a very thoughtful guy. And
no, the movie, I think it does tread familiar ground. It does tell it in a intelligent and
it's his first feature though.
I give him those things, and ultimately the message is definitely worth it, and it's definitely an entertaining movie to watch. So
funny detail about this might inspire some other young filmmakers or budding filmmakers. I think he had the idea of the title, and I believe he set up a Twitter account called Dear White People.
Yeah.
And he started, do you know about this?
No.
Okay. And he started just throwing out ideas there of certain, you know, things that might be gags in the movie. And he kind of used that as a writing tool based on the feedback he got back.
Huh.
I don't know if that account is still active or not. It probably is now that the movie is actually in theaters. And so he's using it to promote that maybe. But
yeah.
I thought that was a unique device in our modern age to try to get feedback, you know?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I think with a lot of racially charged films, you start with sort of the most base stereotypes, you know, or you start with like this idea of where everybody's at,
right.
And then eventually you learn to flip them on their heads. And I thought that this movie executed that pretty well. I mean, honestly, it executed it a little bit better than Crash, which I thought did have some, you know.
A little bit ham-fisted.
Yeah.
Noble attempts going on there.
But yeah. I would say check out Dear White People. It's a entertaining, funny film with a strong message.
Nice.
And then I've also watched some lowbrow picks.
Please.
No easy transition here. I watched Sex Tape with Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel.
This thing kind of disappeared from...
Yeah,
it was from the scene pretty quickly, huh? I mean, what was it in theaters for like 3 weeks or something?
Yeah, it was in and out, and it's pretty much your sort of standard like combination of romantic comedy / you know, raunchy comedy. Yeah.
Sex comedy, basically.
Yeah, sex
right?
comedy. Yeah. And I don't know, so they have the overall message of, you know, oh, you gotta keep romance alive in your relationship or whatever. And there's just not enough funny bits in it. So it stands as
does Jason Segel have a writing component in this? Because oftentimes he chips in that regard.
I don't know if he did have.
You didn't see his credit on that, huh?
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't pay too much attention to that. I mean, he probably did have some influence on what was.
Sometimes these movies that are maybe we would look at as rather subpar comedy features, maybe there's some good supporting players who have some good gags. I mean, is that the case? No?
Rob Corddry. He plays like the best friend,
yeah.
Along with I forget who his wife is, but he has a wife. She was a girl from The Office.
Okay.
And then Rob Lowe is in it, and he has a pretty good turn in the show or in the movie. He's sort of this crazy boss that gets into cocaine.
Might as well, right?
Yeah.
Crazy boss.
Tossing the ranch, right? The ranch.
That's sure.
But yeah, so yeah, I mean, Rob Lowe's
when in doubt, throw in a drug problem, right?
Rob Lowe is entertaining. Rob Corddry is pretty entertaining, but overall, I wouldn't recommend it terribly. I mean, everyone's, you know, doing a decent job, but it's nothing that stands out as a movie that's necessary to watch.
Listen up, everybody. For Sean, decent is not enough.
Yeah.
Until the next pick, right?
I guess this isn't... Yeah, this is definitely
not decent.
This is Transformers 4, Age of Extinction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so this one...
Marky Mark?
Yeah, Marky Mark. All right. Okay. Marky Mark takes over the leading role as
gotta get that payday, right?
The friend to the Transformers.
You know, he's one of those guys, I think I've had this conversation with you, like he he's in a movie that I really care for, and then he does some dross like this, you know, like I know you got like four kids or whatever, dude, but I mean, keep the artistic quality high, I feel. Can you defend his choice here?
I don't know if he's like, I think you're just giving him too much credit.
Perhaps, but I mean, he gets hired by good directors a lot of the time.
I mean, maybe he just plays a certain character really well, though, I think. I think maybe he plays that...
You think he's pretty limited, huh? range-wise?
No, I mean, it might be a little bit limited, but I mean, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt most times.
It's very kind of you.
But then
he can sleep easily tonight. Sean gives him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. But in Transformers 4 Ages of Extinction, I mean, you know, I don't know, he did it in The Happening where he's just like this sort of dude who states emphatically all, like, you know, all his latest problems or issues. And I don't know, there's a pretty funny trailer for Transformers 4 where they talk about how Marky Mark, or Mark Wahlberg, constantly says how he's an inventor throughout the entire film of Transformers 4.
Nice.
I'm an inventor, I know you.
Right,
you know,
right,
I'm an inventor, I need this object so right. I can invent things.
Keep saying it, you might prove it, man.
Yeah. So he's like this really buff inventor. And he has like this small like little place, a small farm, even though he doesn't farm. He has a small farm with his like over sexualized daughter who's like 17, but then everyone's like gawking at her.
Yeah.
And then he finds like old truck. The old truck turns out to be Optimus.
Sure.
And he makes friends with Optimus, and the US government's like pissed off at the Transformers for some reason. And so he tries to protect Optimus as the US government and the new version of the Decepticons chase after him.
Yeah.
And chaos and explosions and just total anarchy, you know, ensues. The thing with these Mark Michael Bay movies is they have like all this like close-up shots of just swirling objects of chaos and action happening.
Yeah.
It's really hard to disseminate what's happening.
Sure. Disorienting. So,
yeah,
right?
Really disorienting. But yeah, I don't know, if you like the continuing trend of, you know, overblown action movies, you can check it out and have a good time. But for most other viewers, I would say no.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that's it for me.
Okay. Yeah, do I disappoint you when I tell you that I have not seen one of those? I mean, there are four now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, is one of them like...
Oh, you're talking about the Transformers.
Well,
yeah,
you told
me
about Harry Potter. There's one, the one directed by, who's that Mexican director that you think that is like, you know, the pinnacle of the series.
The
Harry Potter.
He directed...
It has a weird title, like and the Lord of Azerbaijan or something.
I mean, they all have their weird titles. No, yeah. I think it's The Prisoner of Azkaban.
I'm pretty close, man. Yeah. The Prisoner of Azkaban. Okay.
Azerbaijan.
I haven't seen that one, so maybe I need to check out that. But I mean, among the four Transformers, is there one that's like, hey, we've done four, but this is the artistically, you know...
No, I mean, I don't know.
Integral one to your
life. Same thing, you know, different show, I guess. It's like... Yeah. They're pretty interchangeable. I mean, I guess people would argue that the first one is
the purity unquote, of vision.
Yeah, and then the fourth one, they just, you know, it's like gone down the hill. But I don't know. You can watch the first one, you can watch the fourth one, and you're pretty much like, oh, this is like the same thing, you know. So I feel like overall they're pretty interchangeable.
Okay,
flicks
fair enough.
To watch. Going back to Harry Potter, you know, Prisoner of Azkaban is just it's like a better Harry Potter movie. But if you're not a big fan of the Harry Potter movies, I would not. Recommend
not it. A big fan. I like the couple that we watch for the show, but those are the only two that I've seen. So there's our opening segment. It's a little bit more lengthy than normal, but hey, give us a break. It's our final regular episode. We must enjoy ourselves. This is Highbrow Lowbrow. We're going to transition now to a discussion of two movies from the year 1932. First up, the Best Picture Academy Award winner, Grand Hotel.
Why do you look at me like that?
I had no idea you were so beautiful. I'd like to take you in my arms and not let anything happen to you, ever. How tired you are.
Yes, tired.
And, alone?
So alone. Gekstrahl.
You mustn't talk Russian to me.
Strange man.
Am I so strange to you?
Maybe not so strange now. You know, once when the Grand Duke was alive, I found a man hiding in my room, young officer. Later on, I found him dead.
Well, that was Russia.
Who are you?
Someone who can love you, that's all. Someone who's forgotten everything else but you.
You could love
me. I've never seen anything in my life as beautiful as you are.
So you just heard a clip from the 1932 Best Picture Academy Award winner, Grand Hotel. This film is directed by Edmund Goulding and stars Greta Garbo, John Barrymore, and Joan Crawford. A group of very different individuals staying at a luxurious hotel in Berlin deal with each of their respective dramas. Can you bring it down? I'm going to talk about one actor in particular. I think his name is Lionel Barrymore? Is that it? Yeah, Lionel Barrymore. That dude definitely deserves a you know, commendations in this film, because he does like a lot of the legwork of this film. And we've seen him like a lot another
film. Only remember him from one other movie that we've watched, but
he was in
They Can't Take It With You.
Can't Take It With You.
Yeah, he's the patriarch of that family.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you remember of any others, you can certainly tell me, but I mean,
he does. Yeah. He seems very familiar. I can't recall what else he's been in, but he does seem very familiar. But yeah, so I think
probably from like family pictures, isn't he your great grandfather?
Yeah, totally.
On your dad's side,
right? But two Barrymores in the film—that's interesting.
Well, yeah, it's got to be fun, you know. Yeah. The bros team up and just tear it up, you know. Well, let's actually talk about the quality of the movie. Okay. So I love the premise. I think it's a great premise, mm-hmm. and it's hard to not feel that Wes Anderson took a little bit of it for Grand Budapest Hotel.
Oh,
it has that quality. Yeah. I'm not claiming he ripped at all, but it's that feel to it. You know, it's the same kind of vibe, the same era, the decadence of going somewhere that's, you know, so much unlike home, you're cared for in such a great way. I like the opening. It just swirls into this story that lacks coherency for me. Its tone is inconsistent. It starts funny, it ends funny. There's a lot of weird, unexpected drama in between.
Yeah.
They throw in some romance. It's super padded with Greta Garbo scenes because apparently she complained to the studio head or probably the studio head,
mm-hmm.
Irving Thalberg, I believe. She complained that there wasn't enough of her, or her character wasn't developed enough. So they did reshoots after they had wrapped the whole production to give her more. I mean, did you feel that at times? Like, why are we still in her hotel room right now? Sometimes I felt that. And you either love it or hate it, the way she portrays this Russian this Russian dancer.
Yeah.
Because it's a bit weird, and it's also, I don't know, I guess there was some criticism at the time hiring a Swedish actress to play Russian, which I think that's well within the remit of what you would expect an actor to be able to execute.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I don't have any issues with that, but... and a little bit forgettable, this movie, for me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's...
Share some of your thoughts.
There's nothing that you know, it doesn't tread any new ground in terms of what it tries to accomplish, but I think it does execute some things pretty well.
Yeah.
I think I always enjoy Lionel Barrymore. I mean, I know we've seen him in Can't Take It With You, but he always sort of stands as this emblem of, you know... sticking it to the man a little bit, and then also
in these two movies, he certainly does.
Yeah, I think he's done it in a couple other films too, I think he just executes it really well. Wasn't there another film where he's like a dude that makes stuff, or was that that Can't Take It With You?
I think it's They Can't Take It With You, but I don't know. Remember what he makes? But there are other family members who make stuff within the house. There's the fireworks in the basement. His daughter is a writer.
Yeah, yeah. I thought I really enjoyed Lionel Barrymore's performance as Otto Kring.
Really weird movie. Really weird names in this movie, but I say that as, you know, an Anglophile, I suppose. Because these are essentially just German names, right?
Yeah.
But, I think we're supposed to be transfixed by Greta Garbo as this, like, beauty of the world for all mankind or something. I was actually much more enamored with Joan Crawford.
No, me too.
You
me
felt
too.
That too.
Yeah. I mean, I think, honestly, I felt like Greta Garbo was almost done up too much.
Yeah.
And she just felt a little too ethereal and too, like, not real.
You could maybe make that likeness, that comparison between her, the way her appearance and also Marlena Dietrich, who we'll speak about with our next feature, but especially the really thin and swooping
eyebrow.
Yeah.
I mean, so, I feel like Marlene Dietrich pulled it off a little bit better. She was a little bit more glowy.
I do too. I mean, I like her character better, though, to be honest with you.
But then I think, you know, with Greta Garbo's character...
try to say that, man.
Grusinskaya.
It's like Grusinskaya.
Grusinskaya.
Yeah, nice.
I felt like it was a little bit more forced with her sort of, put upon dancer who's like trapped by her world of glitter and glamour.
Yeah, I was really confused by her choices. I mean, her acting choices. I didn't know what to think, but I did
ultimately become invested. I mean, maybe this is due to the acting ability of
John Barrymore,
yeah. Where I got invested in his story of trying to find money so that he can be with his lady love, you know?
Yes, but that was way too quick, man. Because just 6 hours before, he's romancing Joan Crawford's character.
Yeah.
So he finds himself in Greta Garbo's hotel room, and suddenly he professes his undying love for her. Unless that earlier interaction with Joan Crawford was meant to be some kind of game of deception or something, I didn't believe their immediate love there. We heard a little bit of it in the clip.
Was that
workable for you, or did you just say, it's the movies, I'm fine with it, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess it's, like, fine. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things about, I don't know, I guess I don't have that much, you know, knowledge about attraction, but the dude, I think when he saw Dietrich,
No, Garbo.
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 Just pour her heart out.
In the depths of despair,
and really saw that she was longing for someone. You know, I think that just really sort of, you know, kicked in the white knight in him. Idea like, oh, you know, she needs somebody. I could be that somebody that she needs.
Right.
You know, and I think that's what really sort of, you know, created this bond between the two of them. You know,
right.
Where they were both people in the pits of despair. I mean, him, you know, he's not vocally in despair, but you can sort of see that he's really desperate for money, trying to make enough cash so that he can, like, make the next thing. And I think, you know, that sort of mentality, you know, he's like, oh, maybe I can be with her and, you know, we both can be better with each other or whatever,
right.
You know, that sort of thing.
I get it. I was just a little bit confused by his earlier.
But I mean, I think it's valid, and
it's acceptable to you.
Okay. Yeah, it makes sense, you know, just trying to get away with somebody. And I think with the other character, with Joan Crawford's character, the secretary or the stenographer,
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there's like this level of playfulness and fun, but I think, you know, he sort of establishes that, you know, we're just friends, or we just like playing around with each other by calling her the funny one all the time, you know?
Right.
Oh, hey, you're the funny one.
That, you know? That works. Okay, I get you.
I mean, it reminds me a little bit of Hank in Broadway Melody of 1929.
Oh, yeah.
Because Hank, you know, everyone gets along with Hank, but then no one's enamored with Hank, you know?
Right.
They have, like, this nice dialogue, but no one's going to be like, oh, I want to marry you. I guess, you know, it's a weird trait of, like, the 1930s, or maybe a bit of sentiment from that time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, I mean, this is a problem I have with a lot of movies, maybe older movies in particular, but not necessarily. I mean, I was just thinking back on our journey here, you know, like Out of Africa, that romance didn't work for me. You know, I could just go through the list of them where we're supposed to. I was thinking about Driving Miss Daisy, how glad I was they didn't force a romance in that movie, you know, because that's the one thing that they could have done, and I'm glad they didn't. With this one, then Joan Crawford falls for Lionel Barrymore's character at the very end. I don't believe that at all either. It strains credibility. He just convinces her in some way. I don't know what that was, man. I mean, it looks good to have them riding off in the same car at the end.
Oh, I enjoyed that.
Okay.
No, I liked it because, I mean, I think, you know, they're both in despair over, you know, the passing of, I mean, we were already sort of spoiling it.
It's spoiled, man.
Baron, John Barrymore's character, they're in despair over that. And I think also the fact that, you know, they've just been sort of building up this rapport. I think slowly as the movie comes, you know, goes through, Lionel Barrymore character starts off as this just really sort of down on his luck type of person. You know, he's constantly trying to, like, you know, justify his existence, you know, fighting against his boss and you know, just being stuck in this sort of low spot. And then, you know, he sort of warms up to everybody's hearts, and then you want him to have some luck or have him to win. I don't think Lionel Barrymore's character and Joan Crawford's character necessarily end up together. They're not like a couple. I think they're just two people that...
Just companions.
Companionship. They just need companionship, you know, and they're both like they both know that the Baron, or John Barrymore's character, would have, you know, championed this, or I'm sorry, John Barrymore's character would have championed this, you know, this union, this friendship, you know.
He had brought them together on the dance floor previously.
That's a good point. He loves both people, you know.
I mean, you have more positive feelings about this. You're convincing me to a certain degree about plot points that weren't working. It's interesting to consider this movie as a sort of a pre-Ocean's 11, Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
Because the star power here was supposedly totally immense. Like, I mean, we know Garbo still. We know the Barrymore name, of course. Yeah. We know Joan Crawford. Wallace Beery, Lewis Stone, Jean Hersholt. I mean, these are more vague names, but they're also on the poster.
Yeah.
So, this is an interesting collection of talent. We see it a lot nowadays. I mean, in lesser fare, like what's that recent movie, Valentine's Day or New Year's Eve or those kind of things, where you see like 15, you know, famous star faces you know, going all around the poster. This is definitely not as pandering as that. I think that's a fair argument to make.
Definitely.
But it's, you know, it's kind of shows how these, you know, production companies really, their minds started working. Like, how can we get his fans and her fans and his fans and her fans in here?
Yeah, yeah.
And then get the fans of just movies in general and then get the fans of stardom in general. That said, I just don't think it stands as like a pinnacle film of this era. I mean, perhaps evidenced in the award giving, and that this was, I think it's the only Best Picture winner to not be nominated in any other category at all.
Yeah. I mean, so, yeah, I think it just has like a collection of star power, but it doesn't have any one star that stands out.
Right.
I mean, I do like Lionel Barrymore's performance, but it's not necessarily his movie.
Sure.
And then, you know, the directing style is, it's like there's some good moments in it, but there's not, there's nothing that like is especially like deft in it.
Well, sure. The production design is very lavish and quite beautiful. The way they have that, the hotel lobby, the lobby desk, they are able to get like 360 views of it because they have it as a circular design. And that's pretty incredible. It still looks great.
But I think there also are some like a directorial like misfires or something. Cause,
tell me about it. What?
Like one scene in particular that sort of struck out into my mind was Lionel Barrymore's character, Otto Kringlein or whatever. He comes into his room and it starts off with this like sort of camera crane shot, right?
It's like a villain shot from the Batman TV show.
Yeah, so it's coming down on, and there's like this sort of jaunty music and he's just sort of like slumbering
he's lumbering. Drunk, he's inebriated, and that's the camera device. But I guess it threw you off because it didn't resemble anything else in the picture. It becomes more experimental, you're saying?
No, the thing I disliked about it, because I thought he was going to go into like a musical thing, you know? It had like these beginnings of a musical feel, like this following sort of camera shot where he'd go around and he'd sing about how he's drunk or something, or like living life. I was expecting like a musical portion to it, but then that promise wasn't fulfilled. I was like, well, what am I doing here? I mean, watching him bumble about? I mean,
he fell asleep, man. Well, I think the point of it with that Lionel Barrymore, his character is, you know, he's worked his whole life, worked his, you know, hands to the bone, and he's got a little bit of money stocked away. He's going to the Grand Hotel to spend his last days in his illness. And that shows him enjoying his life. I'm defending the movie now.
I mean, I wonder if that dude in general just likes promoting people living their lives or something. Because he does that.
Say that a lot? Is that?
No, he does that in Can't Take It With You.
Oh, that's true.
Can't work all day long and live your life at work. You gotta live life like you live life. You gotta do what you wanna do with your life.
Right.
And, you know, he said that message in Can't Take It With You. He's saying that message now, you know.
It's a story for all times, apparently, because They Can't Take It With You is on Broadway now, a revival of it, with James Earl Jones as the patriarch and all white people as his children. It's
that's
awesome.
Funny.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That's awkward.
No, it works. It's all good.
All right.
I don't have anything more to say about Grand Hotel, do you?
No, I don't. I did enjoy the film, but it doesn't stand out as like one of the pinnacle Best Picture.
Well, hey, man, let's do what we do and let's do the contrast now. So you're listening to Highbrow Lowbrow, the top box office movie, the lowbrow choice from this same year. Well, we decided it's Shanghai Express.
I took the liberty of presuming that you'd join me for tea.
I hope you don't mind if I prefer to go back to the train.
About 2 days' journey from here into the interior, I have a palace waiting to be graced by your presence. Could I persuade you to accept my hospitality until such time as you should grow weary of me?
I'm weary of you now.
I had no reason to believe my invitation would give offense to Shanghai Lily.
Shanghai Lily has reformed.
You don't mean to say that the eloquence of Dr. Carmichael has worked this miracle? Or is Captain Harvey to be credited with this extraordinary change?
Maybe.
Come, don't be a fool. I'll make it worth your while.
Clip from the 1932 top box office earner, Shanghai Express. Many passengers on the Shanghai Express are more concerned that the notorious Shanghai Lily is on board than the fact that the civil war is going on that may take the trip more than 3 days. This story is about this dude and...
Come on, man. You can do better than this. We're rolling.
Okay, we're rolling with it. So anyway, this story is the story about this military captain who falls in love with the notorious Shanghai Lily, who has a scandalous past, but he's trying to get past it. And all of a sudden, they're threatened by a evil Chinese revolutionary warlord.
Yeah, that's right. Good.
Jesse, what do you think of this lowbrow pick?
Let's talk about the director, Joseph von Sternberg, starring Marlene Dietrich, Clive Brook, and Anna May Wong. What did I think about it? Well, yeah, man, I like this a lot. Very stylish.
Yeah, yeah.
Very stylish. I mean, there's
I'm surprised they gave the starring credit to Anna May Wong.
Well,
I mean, and they even I didn't even know the character's name. I didn't know. I guess it's Hui Fei.
Hui Fei, yeah.
Yeah.
Traveling partner to Shanghai Lily.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what I love about this movie, and this is a small thing, but it's a very important thing, is it casts actual Chinese people as the Chinese characters. Yeah. Like, what a revolutionary idea, you know? So, actually, I was reading a little bit about that particular actress, Anna May Wong. I mean, she was born in L.A., you know? And she's Chinese-American. She's second-generation Chinese. And she left Hollywood for a while, a few years later, when... She was auditioning for this really plum part of a Chinese woman that the studio or the director or whatever, the casting, whoever made the decision, they gave it to a German actress.
Hmm.
You know, this literally a Chinese woman. Yeah. I mean, we've seen this a bit in, you know, just a little bit of personal kind of experience. A couple of years ago, I did that show with Rita Moreno, who starred in West Side Story. Early in her career, she was constant. I mean, she was from Puerto Rico. And she was, I think, Puerto Rican. I think so.
Yeah.
She was constantly playing Hawaiians. like, she probably played some Chinese ladies, too.
Yeah.
You know, so anyone with a little bit of skin tone gets in thrown in. Now, how you get a German to play Chinese, I don't know. So that's a great part of this movie that I don't know where they shot this, actually. Maybe they, I don't know.
I have no idea.
I don't know either. It looks like China. I don't know. Those village scenes.
Yeah.
One of my favorite little passages in the movie is when the train passes through that really narrow corridor.
And they get stuck.
I get stuck by the chickens just standing there.
Yeah.
And the cow and the
dog. Oh, I thought the cow was just like immovable, but then the cow's like specifically tied to the railroad.
Right, that's
and
true.
And I was like, all right, I guess you're presumptuous, but I guess that's how they roll in, that's the presumption of how they roll there.
On the Shanghai Express.
That's on the Shanghai Express. I guess it's not so expressed in that moment.
Yeah, that's true. There's a really interesting plot device here that, again, maybe we could attribute to pre-Hollywood code. In that, Marlene Dietrich plays this notorious call girl.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not explicitly stated, but it's very clear that's what she is.
Yeah.
And the other passengers on the train kind of keep their distance, depending on their, you know, level of poshness or whatever. They keep their distance from her because she's a woman of the night or whatever, a courtesan, whatever you want to say. And yet, there's this British military officer played by Clive Brook, Captain Doc Harvey. I don't remember how he's referred to in the movie. Okay. He's a doctor.
Doc.
Yeah, he's... Doc. Okay.
Yeah.
Who's got this romantic past with her before she became a prostitute and like this legendary thing. And now he's falling for her again.
Yeah.
And it's just a very interesting thing that he's got this, you know, this stuffy air to him. He's
got the,
you know, classical British accent, of course. And Shanghai Lily has got her fingers wrapped around him. And I really like this romance because there's a lot of backstory. They don't need to tell too much about it. But you understand basically that she became a prostitute after they broke up.
Yeah.
And so he's got a lot to get over in terms of, accepting her as a partner, as a mate again, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah, no, it is tough. I mean, I think he sort of falls into it a little too...
A little quickly.
A little quickly.
Hey, it's lonely out there in the Orient, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then also, you know, he does really sort of state that he really did love
and he regrets their
breaking
their
up.
Separation
for like a long time. I mean, the performance that I guess the character turn, I mean the performance is good, but the character turn of, I guess, Hui Fei. Although, honestly, they just refer to her as the Chinese girl throughout the entire film.
Yeah. Do they? I guess so.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't recall her them ever saying her name.
Sure.
But her character arc where, I guess the main villain of this film is Henry Chang, who's the...
rebel leader.
Yeah, Chinese warlord, revolutionary. So he's one who sort of causes this impasse between... everybody, and he holds up the train and holds everyone hostage. So he starts forcing himself upon all the women. He initially tries to force himself on the Chinese woman, and then
initially Shanghai Lily.
Yeah,
and she refuses his advances, and she's got Captain Doc.
Yeah, yeah. But then he just forces himself on the Chinese girl, you know, just as like a secondary prize or whatever.
Right.
And then you're like, well, that sucks. But then she actually gets her revenge, you know, and then she's like, she just does it, you know, and then
she's like the hero of the story.
Yeah,
really.
She's the hero of the story. She's saves everybody.
Right.
You know, and then she's like, let's just go. All right.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just head out. She stabs him in the back, and then just like, let's bounce. All right.
Yeah.
I'm out. I thought that was really, really cool. And she never really gets like a comeuppance for that. I mean, you know, she did have like a really horrendous thing happen to her. So,
well, I like her character arc as well, because again, she's kind of the lowest of the low as a prostitute. Maybe not the lowest of the low, because apparently she's a very good one.
Yeah.
But she becomes a national hero.
Yeah.
You know, which I like. So there's that contrast of like, well, even, you know, this people in this social class that you think is not worthy could do a heroic act for the whole country.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Or at least the region.
And then I don't give these films of this era enough credit, because you know, you had that initial character, the one dude with a mustache, what was his name?
I don't know, man.
I think it was Reverend Mr. Carmichael.
Oh, the missionary guy.
Yeah, the missionary guy,
right?
Lawrence Grant is the actor. So Carmichael, he just condemns everybody and in this role, but then later on his character turns and he sort of like gains a softer edge, and I really sort of appreciated that. He's actually an impetus for like the third act to, you know, bring the couple back together. So I appreciate that story arc for him. I thought you know, there were some interesting turns and interesting plot twists throughout this film.
I love the way it looks. I mean, sometimes black and white photography can just look kind of, I don't know how to describe it, just sullen and dead. The contrasts are not enough.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring something up to you because I read about this. The film is memorable, says Wikipedia, for its stylistic black and white chiaroscuro cinematography. You have any idea what that means?
No.
Apparently that means like extreme contrast between darks and lights.
Huh.
Now, I don't know if I would have put it like that. Maybe there's some person editing this particular entry that's a huge fan. But one thing that... I can't say that stuck out to me the most, but one thing was in the editing, a great use of dissolves in this movie. In particular, there were some that actually almost looked like along the lines of, synchronicity of, let's say, Wizard of Oz with that Pink Floyd album or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Like purposefully he's giving another message with this technical device, you know, like the shadows of the Chinese rebel soldiers on the train as it passes along the tracks, dissolving into something else. You might remember that one.
Yeah, yeah.
There were other instances like that where, you know, the juxtaposition of two images laid over one another was actually just brought more kind of visual poetry.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the environments a lot too. They were very sort of cluttered, and I think that was like a really cool aspect of the film is just the level of clutter and the layering too. You know, especially with the sort of netted doorways. You know, how he burns the netted doorways and how he uses that to transition from one room to another room. Mm-hmm. You also see a lot of scenes through these sort of nettings. You know.
This is an interesting contrast of two movies, Grand Hotel and Shanghai Express. Grand Hotel, completely in a hotel.
Yeah.
Shanghai Express, almost completely in a train. You know, it's a double feature that would work pretty well, actually, in terms of like a confined experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Where would you rather be? I mean, I'd probably rather be in the Grand Hotel.
Yeah.
It feels a little safer.
Yeah, yeah. It's not as chaotic as a crazy
train. Man.
No cows holding us up in the Grand Hotel.
So maybe a final discussion point. I mean, these are, I don't know if they were, you know, sometimes these actors maybe have sort of a rivalry of some sort. I don't know the backstory, but maybe Garbo and Dietrich were kind of friendly rivals or something. Yeah. I don't know, but Dietrich kind of rules the day here.
Oh,
I
no.
Feel. Yeah.
Dietrich does a really sort of fantastic job. I mean, she pulls off that that sort of mysterious, sort of airy, you know.
I thought you were going to say Aryan.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, man. She was Aris, German. All right.
Aris feel to her so well. So with such like grace, but like an aloofness that I really appreciated. Mm. I really enjoyed her role in the film.
In the hands of a better director, perhaps, though. Yeah. Can't say I have enough experience with Garbo's performances to critique it against others, but.
Yeah. I mean, so, but I did. I thought Dietrich pulled it off well, and then she's a much more dynamic character than Garbo's is. Hmm. She's like this lady of the night, but then she also has her pride, and whereas Garbo is just this sort of, you know, put upon dancer, Dietrich has this sense of, you know, she still has her dignity and she has her love, and she also has this like big past that she has to deal with. But I think it she carries it all, and she carries it all with a knowing wink. And that's something I really appreciate about Dietrich's performance.
Nice. There's our discussion of Shanghai Express from 1932. We're going to take a short break before we come back to wrap things up on this episode of Highbrow Lowbrow.
So you just heard our review of the 1932 Best Picture Academy Award winner, Grand Hotel, and the top box office earner, Shanghai Express. Jesse, which film did you end up liking more?
I felt like Grand Hotel overall is mediocre. Maybe just the way it holds up over time didn't really work for me. Shanghai Express, much more stylish. I like the acting. The actor's much better. I like the storyline. I like the depth of character much better. I like the Chinese actors when it should be Chinese actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, seems like a small point, but actually is a rare thing in that era.
Yeah.
So Shanghai Express was a good discovery for me. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm going to go with Shanghai Express, although it's like only a marginal pick over Grand Hotel. I enjoyed both movies. I enjoyed Grand Hotel more than you did. And Shanghai Express doesn't stand out as much as it does in your mind, but I do think Shanghai Express is the more important and more interesting film to check out. But I think both films have their own worth, and you know, if you are trying to get a sense of film history or get a sense of films from that era, I think both movies are worth a watch.
That's a fair comment. Well, I think normally we do every 10 episodes a little summation of the 10 that have come before and try to share our sort of top picks. We're going to keep it more brief here because we only did a six-episode arc here, 81 to 86, to come to the conclusion of our journey here. And so let me just, I'll just read them off real quickly, Sean. Episode 81 from 1977, we watched Annie Hall and Star Wars A New Hope. Episode 82 from 1983, we watched Terms of Endearment and Star Wars, Return of the Jedi. Episode 83 from 1934, we watched It Happened One Night and The Merry Widow. Episode 84 from 2013, we watched 12 Years a Slave and Iron Man 3. Episode 85 from 1942, we watched Mrs. Miniver as well as Bambi. Episode 86, this one you just heard, you know what we did. So Sean, sort of a best picture choice out of that bunch there. That's a highbrow choice. What's your pick of the bunch?
Well, my pick of the bunch, I mean, I like 12 Years a Slave. Like, that's probably the one that like stands out most to me in terms of like my favorite film out of all of them. Although I will make a mention of Terms of Endearment, because I thought this was a film that I wasn't expecting. I didn't really have much knowledge of. And it just sort of stood out to me as this very entertaining, very unique sort of family dramedy that had a lot of laughs and had a lot of love and was told in a unique way. So, yeah, I mean, people should see 12 Years a Slave because it's definitely an important and noteworthy film. But I think people will be surprised by Terms of Endearment and just how entertaining it is.
I didn't care for Terms of Endearment as much as you did, and that's well documented. the turn in the final third of the movie is just way too melancholy and just over the top emotionally for me, and I don't feel like it really made any sense. with the rest of the storyline. But then again, life gives us surprises that we don't expect, i.e. sudden illnesses, a.k.a. someone dying that you thought was not going to die. All right, I'm not into that. But yeah, I agree. The strongest movie here that pretty much knocked me off my seat was 12 Years a Slave. Incredible, poetic, great performances. Fassbender, oh my gosh, yeah. Man. That guy just, he's seared into my memory. But yeah, as a secondary pick, which is kind of what you did, I really enjoyed Mrs. Miniver from 1942. I'd never heard of that movie before, as I said at the beginning of this episode, at the outset, directed by William Wyler, who's a sort of a new favorite of mine, sort of a maybe a forgotten giant, not by many, because... not by everyone, many people still know him, but he's not necessarily mentioned in the same breath as the great American directors. Yeah. We think of different figures. So Mrs. Miniver, I thought, really had a lot of worthwhile content as well.
Yeah.
How about among the lowbrow, the top box office movies from this bunch? Sean, what would you say?
With the lowbrow picks, I don't know. I mean, I think it sort of ends up being... the Star Wars in general, like Star Wars A New Hope and Star Wars Return of the Jedi. Honestly, like, it depends on the day, I can go either way.
Yeah.
I think I'm more inclined to go with Return of the Jedi. I mean, I know it's the more sort of childish film of the two, but I just like the lavish production style of Return of the Jedi. And then just the closing out of the trilogy is just feels so satisfying to me. So Return of the Jedi is a classic, a sci-fi film. But one film I also want to make a mention of is Bambi. I think people should check that out because of the way that it has it. I think on revisiting the movie, you'll discover more about Bambi. And in terms of it's a kid's film, but then it also has this sort of interesting arc of growing up and becoming an adult, and also gives you a good sort of idea or sense of nature in its own weird anthropomorphized way. Bambi, I think it has a lot of deeper lines running into it, and I thought that was an interesting film to watch in this era.
For me, I'll just keep it current here. I really enjoyed Shanghai Express. So I say it on this show quite a bit, but the thrill of the new is what's good for me. And so that's been the most fun part of the journey maybe here is experiencing new movies and seeing actors from an era that, of course, I was not alive. So Shanghai Express from 1932 really was just a great artistic achievement. I liked it a lot, and it makes me intrigued to check out more Marlene Dietrich and director Joseph von Sternberg collaborations, because they did 7 or 8 movies together, apparently. And there must be a couple other notable features among those. Because Shanghai Express, the quality really impressed me, and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Awesome.
So this is Highbrow Lowbrow. You can find us on the web at hlpod.blogspot.com or on Facebook, Highbrow! Lowbrow! Sean, tell our audience what we're doing next.
All right. So we're still planning out our final episode. We're going to be discussing what we're going to be in talks, trying to figure out what exactly we're going to be doing for the final episode. But we will have one more episode where we wrap up our entire idea of, this entire journey that we've been on, all the movies, we'll discuss which films we ended up enjoying. We'll also try to have maybe some possibly interactive elements, some, guests. I also want to say really quickly right now, we really appreciate all the guests that have been with us on these past 6 episodes. Michael Misek helped us review 12 Years a Slave and Iron Man 3. Jack helped us review Mrs. Miniver and Bambi. Changa helped us review Annie Hall and Star Wars A New Hope. And Crystal helped us review, Terms of Endearment and Star Wars Return of the Jedi. They're all really good friends of ours, and we've really enjoyed having them on the on the podcast with us. They may make an appearance for our final episode, or may have some sort of presence on our final episode. We're not exactly sure, but we will have a fantastic, be sure to check in, final episode that will just cover our entire journey, and we'll both give our final opinions on what this was like and how we enjoyed it.
There it is, Sean. 4 years of our life encapsulated in a 1-minute synopsis there. Nice. I've done other things beside this show. I want the audience to know. We hope you'll join us once again next time when we try to find out who was right.
The critics or the masses?